You're listening to
Cat Tales. Hi, I'm Kat, and you're listening to Cat Tales. Gizbutt became a household name in 1996 when he became lead guitarist with The Prodigy, just as the Fat of the Land album became number one in 38 countries at the same time. But that's not all he's done in his musical career. He's been in English Dogs, The More I See, The Destructors, and played live with the Foo Fighters and the Beatles' Pete Best. Now he's about to relaunch his band Janus Stark with an exciting new release and is planning a tour. This is the one with Gizbutt. So here I am in sunny Peterborough, and it's a beautiful sunny day.
Has been for a while.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And I'm sitting here with Gizbutt, so welcome to the show.
How are you doing, Kat?
I'm doing really well.
Welcome, everyone.
Yeah.
Listeners.
Yes, listeners, listeners. So what it brings a man like you to a place like this?
Peterborough.
Yeah.
Fate, life, my parents. Things were going a bit strange in Manchester. It was when I was like 10, 11 years old. And my dad, bless him, he was getting into a little bit of trouble on the old juice.
Mm-hmm.
And something happened in Manchester where he basically got into an accident, and he got his driving licence revoked.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working for Hot Point, and it just looked a better opportunity for him to get down to Peterborough, and he wouldn't need a car for a while.
Yeah.
So, and he would get promotion. And I think that Hot Point was developing at that time. So it'd be like 1977, 78. So he went for it. And we came down and we moved into Orton Melbourne, and it was all very new.
Yeah.
And I moved into a new school. I started off at Orton Longville, but then I went into a school called Bushfield.
Yes.
And it was very new. And there was only 3 years there, first, second and third. And it was a good time.
Yeah, sounds like you've got some fond memories of it. Well, of course, at that time, Hot Point was very big here, wasn't it, in Peterborough?
Yeah, and music was very big. Mm. 78, there was, you know, the punk rock explosion was starting to... the tentacles of it were, like, going out into new wave and such. There was a lot of music everywhere.
Mm.
And there was a lot of great bands, and you'd watch Top of the Pops and there'd always be good bands on it. And, you know, 11, 12 years old, and picking up a guitar. I'd already started to play the guitar when I was living in Manchester. And I was already, like, a big fan of the Beatles, and
yeah.
I was already a fan of... I mean, I love Lynyrd Skynyrd. The
mm-hmm.
first thing I wanted to do was learn how to play Lynyrd Skynyrd
Freebird
material, but there was no way I was going to... Well, actually, my favourite song was a song called Things Going On.
Okay.
And but there was no way I was going to play that. So instead I was learning Beatles songs
yeah.
and punk rock, which was, you know, happening in Manchester, because that was like the sister city to London with as far as the punk rock scene mm. was concerned.
Mm.
And the bands were getting some coverage, and they were playing up there, and you could see Sex Pistols playing Anarchy in the UK on Granada TV at 10:30 on a Sunday evening. So
yeah.
that was quite exciting, because, you know, they were banned, so
yeah.
it was like, what's the fuss about? And it was a good time. But then moving to Peterborough, being a northerner, coming into an eastern city, which was very different. I came from a place that was full of cotton mill chimneys,
yeah,
and coming into a place of flat fields,
yeah,
and
bit of a shock.
It was different. I mean, I was just at that age, but I was like torn away from any friendships that I'd made, and I had to start afresh. And the first friendship that I had was with my guitar.
Yeah, I can see that, and actually, that I can see that would be your friend and actually your confidant in a way, and mm. allow you also to express yourself and to get out some of those emotions of that upheaval, I guess, for somebody of 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the punk rock movement obviously attracted you. What particular part of that? Was it the freedom, the expression, the fact that you could just say
well,
anything
the
you
sound
want?
Was great.
Mm-hmm.
There was an energy to it that obviously existed within a lot of great heavy rock bands, but this was speaking more to me, you
uh-huh.
know. Obviously, if I'd been a little bit older, you know, maybe it'd been different. I might have picked up on things like, you know, Black Sabbath,
yeah.
Led Zeppelin. I did actually get some of that through my brother,
because
he was a big heavy rock fan. And but punk rock, it was at that age, you know. As I said before, then it was all Beatles.
Yeah.
But I was just at that age, and I was interested in this thing, and there was so much energy in it. It's the energy. I mean, there were people saying there's a lot of swearing going on, it's outrageous. I guess when you're 11, that's quite attractive.
Yes, absolutely. It certainly is, isn't it?
They probably are at all ages.
Yes.
But the music, just one after another, just hearing the music of the Sex Pistols, The Clash, The Damned, Buzzcocks, Eddie and the Hot Rods, you know, the endless stream of UK Subs Angelic Upstarts and... the new wave bands, so like or post-punk bands, Joy Division, Magazine, The Cars, Boomtown Rats.
Sure.
It was just one
amazing
after another.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was just this is the most exciting time for music.
Yeah, I think that's true actually, and I speak to a lot of artists who were in punk bands, and they all say the same thing about that energy and the fact that you could really get something to and felt that you were making a difference, because I think at that time Britain needed a difference, didn't it?
Yeah. And I needed a difference at that age. So when I was 12 and I was, you know, in school making new friends and picking up a guitar and forming a band, and then I was getting my first band together and playing, I think the first song I ever played live was the Kids Are All Right.
Okay.
The Who song.
Yep. Good choice.
Eddie and the Hot Rods did a cover of that.
Yeah, they did.
On the Teenage Depression album.
Oh, right.
And,
you know your music.
and I really... So I was doing that and then covering Tonight, Drummer Man and Sex Pistols stuff inside the school.
Right.
When you're a school band, you know...
It's pretty cool.
It is great. You know, people pay attention to you. You get some... recognition.
Just a bit, and lots of attention from the opposite sex too, which all goes down quite well.
People like you because you've got something.
You're popular.
And then, of course, you know, you're right, writing lyrics, you know, and learning about what you're writing lyrics about.
Yes, yeah.
So for the first time, it was kind of like, well, you know, it's actually good to maybe deny someone of, you know, what they're trying to impose on you, or... you know, to refuse something or to question something and to learn about what it is that's being expected or demanded of you, and do you agree with it? Is it part of your inner moral? And is this the route that you want to take?
That's interesting. So did you find that music was actually a kind of therapy to allow you to explore those feelings within yourself?
It was. I mean... it was a way of learning things and just asking this question, what route do I want to go down?
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're a youngster, you experience things and you just make your decision, is this where I want to be?
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, I saw a lot of aggression. You know, when I was living in Manchester and I saw it, you know, in the family, you know, my dad was quite an aggressive person.
Mm-hmm.
He was always going out and drinking every night. But he was a good person, he meant well, but unfortunately he was part of his generation.
Sure.
And I just had to question that. Did I want to be part of that? No, I didn't. But I'm not saying he didn't do anything good, he did. And I'm not saying that any of those people didn't do anything good, they did. Well, they were products of their generation. Why are they drinking every night? They're probably trying to blot something out.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they're probably trying to sort of, you know... It's a painkiller.
Yes.
It's a painkiller for a crap way of living.
Yes.
You know, so I needed to question those kind of things.
And thought that's not for you as well. You didn't want a future like that, maybe, and just...
No, I didn't want his future, but I think that's always part of something as... It's a constant, never-ending thing. You never stop doing it.
Yeah.
You always question, am I... putting myself in my own prison, a prison of my own making, and you know, if I am doing, then I need to sort of like quickly get the key.
Yes, absolutely. No, you're right there, actually. And I think life gives you those times, doesn't it, where it presents it and you think to yourself, actually, I'm at crossroads now and perhaps I've got to free myself, or perhaps I've got to make sure that I don't get bound into something that I don't want to. And perhaps I'm suggesting maybe that music has given you a way of not be conforming in a way, actually having that freedom to go and kick against the trends and do something different.
It gives you many things. I mean, it gives you great friendships, the best in the world, you know, and, you know, the actual music, which in itself, which is absolutely magical.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you can do with that. Where you can be creative,
yeah,
and you can get lost in it.
Yes.
If you need a painkiller, you know, I think the best one is music.
Yeah, yeah. Either playing it or listening to it. So either way, it's a two-way street, isn't it?
Yeah.
So after, you know, coming down here, you've obviously been in quite a few bands, you know, during that time of adolescence, shall we say. Mm. How did you get the big break for you, really, which you've got to say is the Prodigy, possibly the biggest band in terms of names? Do you feel that was your biggest break, or was there another one?
Well, it was the biggest break as in terms of sales.
Yeah.
You could say that when Gizbut was in the Prodigy, they were at their commercial peak.
Yeah.
They experienced having a number one album in 38 countries consecutively.
Wow. That's brilliant, isn't
it?
That is some record, isn't
it? I mean,
you've got to be proud of that.
Whatever anyone says, you know, when I was with them, when I joined them, it was like, they were still enjoying the success of Firestarter.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after me being with them for a short space, length of time, it was smack. No,
wow.
No. It was Breathe, yeah. Mm-hmm. On the B side of the Breathe single, they also added a live cover of Their Law. My name is mentioned on that.
Oh, great.
If you hear it.
Great.
That could be an opportunity for playing it.
Okay.
But, you know, you'd probably be deleting a few of the words.
That's the only problem.
And, yeah, then after that, there was Smack My Bitch Up, which, I mean, these singles all went to number one.
Yeah.
Maybe Smack My Bitch Up went to number two, but, you know, number one, number two.
Yeah.
You know, it was
either
a good
way,
place.
My God, you know, that's an accolade, isn't it? Let's be honest.
And, no, I think it was number one. But anyway.
It's so long ago, we can't remember.
It
was good.
But it was a successful time. And, you know, being in a band that has a number one, which I did, I was in a band and we had a number one. So
doesn't get
I
any
experienced
better.
That.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you could have a number one and it's your songs or you're part of the team that wrote them. I did have that. I enjoyed that feeling with Jaina Stark. We had a top 40 hit.
Yes, yes.
So that was a great feeling.
So, yeah, so in a way, you've got the number one which you're performing on, but actually when you're writing and also inputting, it is a different feeling, isn't it?
You know, the leader of the band. I mean, Jaina Stark is a band that it was essentially my band.
Sure.
You know, so that in itself has its thing. When you bring people together, or when something changes and you say, right, you know, we're going to start afresh and we're doing it this way, and I've got an idea of doing it like this, we've followed your way for the last few years, that didn't work, now we're going to do it my way.
Sure.
You know, and that's what happened with Jaina Stark.
And did that sort of the feeling of, I'm not going to say power, but control, I think, isn't it, the fact that you're controlling your destiny, controlling choices, did that
controlling choices
or maybe not,
you know, the thing is there's a sound that I hear, and that's what I would like to hear. There's a musical legacy that I guess all musicians leave behind.
Sure.
And you want it to be the thing that you was aiming for. Mm. And with Jaina Stark, that is the musical legacy that I was aiming for.
Wow.
I did it with some other things as well. I was quite happy about... I had a band called The More I See. I think we did quite well with some of that. But Jaina Stark definitely overall gave me the best feeling. There's a certain thing that for me gives me absolute happiness. You know, I love the sound of a great loud guitar, you know. I love the sound of you know, an up-tempo beat. You know, I love the sound. I like the sound of a guitar solo.
Sure.
You know, so
you're able
a bunch
to.
Of ingredients.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a mixing pot, isn't it? Really.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've been...
A cracking snare, shimmering hi-hat. You know, there's certain things that in a sound, you know, you want. Now, when Jaina Stark, I had the ability to be able to control that sound because it's my... It was, you know, this is the turning point, you know. This is my band now. Mm-hmm. So the album that we came out with was Great Adventure Cigar, and it was mixed by a producer called Terry Thomas. He produced and mixed it, and he... We used a wealth of instruments on that. We used guitars, like 1959 Les Pauls that previously belonged to Mick Jones, a Foreigner.
Terrific.
And we had like Marshalls that had been souped up that belonged to Bad Company and things like this. So we had this great equipment and this man at the helm. And then with me saying those guitars are going to get turned up.
Yeah, to 11.
You know, previously they had.
No. Do you look back on those days and think, do you know, I wish that I was still involved in that? I mean, obviously you're involved in music now. We'll come on to talk about that. But do you look back on those days thinking, although the younger days were the best, or is it actually now what you're doing today that you feel is the best accolade that you will leave?
Well, the Prodigy, the reason why I'm not in them anymore is because things got messy. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I will always believe that Liam is a great songwriter and he is the genius behind that band. But it's not a normal band.
No.
It's not a band that went from being in a transit van and touring up and down the UK to, you know, getting a hit. It was a band that was born from the rave culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was Liam who was the songwriting genius who was influenced by rock bands and grunge bands and punk bands.
Yeah.
And he was the genius that was trying to bring this through in the way how he did it. The other guys that he had in the band were good entertainers, but they weren't musicians.
Right, okay.
And so, you know, certain things took priority over, you know, what should be the music. So, like, for instance, you know, it's one of the trappings of success is you find... like a hierarchy going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I believe that, you know, a couple of the people involved in the band kind of lost their original true self. I mean, I could even say that to an extent about myself because, you know, before I joined that band, you know, I was, you know, a punk rock guitarist in the English Dogs and had all, you know, what I wore tight black jeans.
Yeah.
And next minute I'm, you know, hanging out with people that have got a heck of a lot of money.
Yes.
And maybe I'm losing some of my vision.
Yes, it's interesting.
But I did get it back.
Yes.
And I'm glad I've got it back because, you know, that part of things I don't miss.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously I could go back there and say, oh, well, if I had that success now, I'd do it differently. And of course I would.
Yeah.
But...
it's interesting how many people say that, you know.
I enjoyed having that time, and I can't see any reason why I can't have that time again, but with a different setup, you know.
Mm.
I really believe that I can. But, you know, like what I was saying earlier, when you're with people that have got this shared experience of going from, you know, a rough environment, not particularly comfortable, being in a transit van, and, you know... The mad things that we used to do. We used to create seats in the back of the van, totally illegal. We didn't have seats there. We put speaker caps on and we draped the backdrops over it and made it look like a seat. Everyone sits in the back of that and then go travelling around Europe on that.
Oh, wow.
You know, and we did that and we got away with it. And we got stopped by the police and we still didn't get prosecuted. And we did that for years and that kind of experience, you know. And we slept on floors and we, you know, we ate with different kind of people. We ate all forms of food, vegetarian, vegan. We ate with people that were quite, you know, tough guys. Then we ate with people that were very peaceful guys. But everyone treated us with respect. And, you know, we were able to go from that level onto another level with the mind of the first level. But the thing is, with the Prodigies, I really believe that that first level was never there in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, it's odd. Looking back, you also obviously have a different view of it than you did at the time. And what was interesting there that you said that perhaps you also changed with that process of being part of such a successful setup. Do you feel that now the other side of it, you're able to bring through those experiences and learn from them sufficiently to enhance what you're doing?
Well, right now, what I'm doing is thinking of like a video that I'm creating for a song, which is like the comeback song for Jaina Stark.
Right.
So instead of doing what I maybe did, what I could have done like many years ago, which was, right, I need to write 12, 15, 17 songs, create an album, then let's see what I'm going to do with it next.
Yeah.
This time round, I'm actually thinking, well, I've written a number of songs. A certain amount of them have come to completion. One of them's really polished. I'm doing a video for that. So great. I'm actually, for me, the whole representation of the video with the song and then putting that right out there onto YouTube and Facebook and, you know, whatever platforms. But even this one song to start off with is more important because, you know, time is important.
Yes, yes, it is. It's amazing that you're saying this because I've spoken to quite a few artists in a very similar position to you who are taking exactly the same kind of approach. And instead of having the old, I guess call it the old fashioned way, but the good old way of doing the whole album, putting it out there, they are looking at that one song and let's do the whole package and mark it on the back of that.
Or, well, I would like to do a video for every song and it goes out like that, video after video after video. There's certain things that, well, I would like to do, I live in Peterborough, and I've seen a lot of Peterborough, and I've seen a lot of great places. I've seen a lot of places that hold something special for me. There's various parts of Peterborough that I've got a lot of strong feelings for.
Yeah.
And it's really just part of growing up here and appreciating this area and this city and the people in it.
Right.
Which are some of the and also the music here. I've been in New Orleans and thought to myself, the music in Peterborough is better.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I mean that.
Yes.
Yeah, so the musicianship in this area is top notch, and the people are great. So I thought, you know, each video could have some symbol, some Peterborough item in there. I mean, right now we're sat here at the embankment, which in itself
iconic in itself, isn't it?
A site, an area, and there's different reasons why. On the embankment, if I look to my left, the Destructors played an outdoor performance here in 1983, which was a great, great time. And that performance, the video of that now is still on YouTube, and that is a legacy that it's leaving. Which, that's the kind of legacy that I want to leave, because these time, as time goes, these beautiful things that you experience, that you happen, that you think, they get lost in the ether unless you put them out there.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to do that and hold to it, you know, people that have shown me kindness, and also, you know, these places that I'll use the word resonate.
It's I get you. I get it.
Word that everyone likes to use. They resonate with me. You know, if you think of Peterborough, what places do you think of? You know, you'll think of the cathedral. You'll think of the Lido or something that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you think hard enough, you're going to get a lot of them. Thorpe Hall, just keep on thinking. They are there. People keep on saying Peterborough's got nothing. Get out of here.
It sounds like you want to be a nice ambassador for the place.
It's
actually, it's got into your heart there. Despite, you know, has Manchester now left you?
No, I love Manchester. I love Liverpool.
And Liverpool.
Yeah, my great-granddad was a conductor in a theatre in Birkenhead.
Oh, wow. Birkenhead.
Yeah, and when the talkies came along, it might have even been earlier than that. I think that when the talkies came along, the work dried up.
Mm-hmm.
So he moved to Manchester with my grandma, so his daughter.
Yeah.
And to take on the work that was still present then in Manchester. But then that dried up.
Yes.
And so my grandma met my granddad in Manchester, and family sort of, you know. My mum met my dad.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was born over there. And then we moved down here to Peterborough. But yeah, my great granddad, he actually drank himself to death because of no work.
No.
And
then you've gone into an industry that is actually renowned for those kind of temptations, shall we say, sex, drugs, rock and roll, and drink. How have you managed to retain yourself without going down a similar route?
Well, you hear these words, don't you? Dogging.
Right.
Felching. Strip poker. It sounds quite attractive.
That's the secret then.
You know,
well, perhaps you wouldn't like to comment.
It's all a bit of a laugh.
Yeah, of course.
I remember being at school when we used to try and make ourselves faint. Mm. We used to really breathe really hard, like for about a minute non-stop, and then a friend of ours would come up behind us and squeeze really hard and we'd just faint, and for us that was like, it'd be really bad. And then I remember when I was like 14 and I'd see people around town glue sniffing and I thought, oh man, that's bad. Mm. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Never done that.
There are limits. But it is a difficult industry, isn't it? I mean, it's changed a lot over the years as well, though. I think everybody now is coming out the other side of those sort of bad days, aren't they now?
I was in a German band for 3 years, and the band is Pyogenesis. So I had a great time. But the booze was just really just becoming... Mm. Like, way too important. You know, we'd arrive at the venue, the lead singer and the bassist straight away. I'm going to start drinking now.
Yes.
You know, and it was like, hold on, wait a minute, we've got a gig to do. I've just been practicing like crazy to make sure that we know perfect. You know, get on the stage.
Yeah.
All you hear is these notes getting dropped everywhere by everyone.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh man.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I was stuck that for 3 years and then I just thought, you know, this is just not what I want at all. Mm. And, people turning up to the gig and then just hitting the bottle from the second that they walk into the dressing room. And then, you know, when you're on stage, actually during the course of the actual gig, having like 10 vodka and, you know, orange, or, you know, just having like 10 gins or 10 Bacardis during the course of the gig and just constantly playing wrong notes. No way, I don't want that.
Mm.
No, that was a drag.
Mm.
You know, and the worst thing is, you know, all right, you know, you might... There might be, you know, you might sort of like come across someone who's involved in some other recreational thing or whatever, you know, and that, you know, like that gets treated as if you're a criminal.
Yeah.
And yet, you're going and hitting that bottle every time, you know, it's just like, no, well, that's, that's not the way for me. You know, I want to get on stage with a clear head and, you know, play some really good music
and perform well. There's so many musicians say the same thing now, that they've sort of come through that phase and actually now they're into, you know, vegan diets and sparkling water and actually, you know, proper preparation before they do go on stage.
It's if you want to play really well before a gig, that's great, isn't it? Just for a start, that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've played with the Dizzy Miss Lizzies, and it's probably one of the most fun band that I've ever played with in my life, which is essentially a cover band.
Mm-hmm.
And started off by playing Beatles covers. We played with Pete Best in Liverpool. And, you know, we've done gigs in Peterborough where the first set, everyone's completely, just had water. And then on the second set, you'll have a couple of drinks. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the set, you know, you... Maybe I could have had like one less, you know. But you know, we're kind of involved with the audience, and we're the course of the evening has been going with the audience, because those gigs you do a long set, you know, you can play for 3 hours.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of the night, you know, everyone's kind of like very, very, you know, totally 100% sober. And then by the end of the night, you might have had a couple of shandies, but you know, essentially you're entertaining the audience and you're growing with, as the night goes, you go with your audience and you're, you know, you're bringing them in and they're having fun with you. As long as you're able to still pull it off on that last note, as long as you're still not making a fool of yourself, then then you've done it. And hitting the notes, of course.
Of course. So it sounds to me like you like that live performance and the interaction with the audience. Oh, is that sort of better than the recording sessions and actually the sale of the music?
Well, no, the recording sessions is what sticks around afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that really means a lot to me.
Yeah.
Because that's the legacy.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I love playing to people, and I love when we play with them, I get them involved, you know.
Sure.
I get them singing along, I get them dancing, I get them on the tables, you know, maybe ripping items of clothing off, you know, if it's getting a bit hot. But just getting them smiling, for me, the whole thing is more like projecting a feeling of love, you know.
Mm.
And getting them to maybe see that and feel it themselves and pass that on.
Yeah. So the video that you're now currently doing, how far down the stage are you of getting it produced?
It's going to be filmed in two different locations. And we have a treatment.
Ooh.
That's the correct word.
Oh, I say.
Yeah, which is a storyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got two locations. So I've said that already.
Mm-hmm.
The locations are really great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have some people to thank for that.
Locally,
I
are
don't
they?
Know if I should name their names because they might not want me to, but mm-hmm. they know who they are.
Right.
Cheers, Justin. And Phil Berridge is the director. So, you know, and I'm going to say a quick thanks to Mark Simlow as well because he's right behind this first one.
Brilliant.
And it's just great, you know. The places that we've got. Yeah.
Sounds exciting. So when is it out then?
Well, the first filming's on August the 4th.
Wow.
So that's the first one. Then we've got to do the second one.
Yeah.
And then we've got to do the edit, but
autumn.
You know, everything's always like time restraints all the time, you know, because August is a difficult month. I'm going on a holiday for a start.
Oh, it's your fault then, really, isn't it?
Well, the holiday was booked first.
Oh dear. Oh, well, do you know what, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I can't wait to see the video
before we leave.
Yeah,
together. I can, but not for this, but
yeah,
for, I can give you a quick preview of the song.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. Love to hear it. A sneaky
step inside,
sneaky bit. Perfect.
Yeah.
That will
for
be
your
great.
Ears only.
For my ears only. Love it. Oh, that'd be absolutely wonderful. Well, I wish you all the best with the whole music stuff that's coming out, the new stuff. I can't wait to hear.
New Jaina Stark.
The new Jaina Stark. The videos, which are certainly sound like they're going to be exciting and going to be leading the way, which has got to be the way, hasn't it, with, you know, visuals as well as the audio.
Yes.
And tells the story, doesn't it?
And the first comeback gig in the UK, which will be November the 24th.
Okay.
At the Ostrich in Peterborough.
Wow.
And I promise that will be like a very fun packed and packed night. It's going to be hot in there. There's going to be people like literally right up to the ceiling. There's going to be people in there, you know. They're going to have to dance on the bar.
They're going to have to. That'll be me. I will be there.
On the tables and the bar.
Absolutely. You can guarantee it. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I wish you all the success with everything else. I really do.
Thank you, Kat.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you. You've been listening to Kat Tales. To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattales.co.uk.